The 42-day Desert Storm Air War was the most successful air campaign in military history. In this episode, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry and I finish our conversation about Desert Storm by taking a detailed look at the employment of the air campaign.
This is the Air Minded Podcast.
Welcome back to the Air Minded Podcast. I'm your host, Tyson Gorilla Wetzel. This is the second part of an interview I did with Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry. I hope you listened to the first part, and honestly, this will make a lot more sense if you have listened to that episode. So if you haven't, I'd suggest downloading and giving that one a listen. In this episode, Slam and I highlight and discuss what we saw as the critical events of Desert Storm, in particular the air war, including the first night, the strategic air campaign, the battle for air superiority, the Great Scud Hunt, the Battle of Kafji, and the ground war, and the critical supporting capabilities that made this air campaign so successful. We'll finish by talking about what went right and what went wrong in the air war, and we'll debate the importance of the air campaign and what lessons we can and should take out of this air war. This is not a comprehensive rundown of the major events of Desert Storm, but rather it's what Slam and I felt were the most important subjects to hit on. I hope you enjoy part two of this interview. Be sure to tune in next week for the final episode in this Desert Storm 30 series, my interview with MiG Killer and the weapons officer of the 58th Tactical Fighter Squadron, the top MiG-killing unit of the war, Rick Clouseau-Tellini. And now, on to the conclusion of my interview with Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry. All right, Slam, welcome back from our tactical pause. We are now getting into the actual war, so we're going to be talking Desert Storm. So Desert Storm kicks off on the 17th, early in the morning on the 17th of January of 1991, 16th of January, back home in America, in one of the worst examples of Operation Security. Everybody had a pretty good idea we were kicking off the war because a bunch of pizzas were being delivered to the Pentagon on the night of the 16th. I think that is a pretty funny anecdote. So we now know not to order pizzas when you are about to kick off a war. Let's talk a little bit night one. I think it is maybe the most exciting night of air power employment that at least I can think of. It's one of those, like we talked about in the intro, I know exactly where I was, exactly what I was doing. I was 12 years old at the time, and it just captured my imagination. And it was so different. It was amazing what we were able to do with the air campaign. And then as we started to see them do press conferences and see bombs go through windows and hitting bridges before vehicles went across them. And it was just everything about it really was shockingly different. And at least for me, that I think was a major moment in my love of air power. And you kind of mentioned it, same thing for you.
Yeah, it was a staggering moment for Americans and for a young teenager interested in joining the military. It was an absolutely life-shaping moment. And as you alluded to, the arguably the most important and impressive night of air power since the Air Force was created in 1947. You certainly can make that argument. As we alluded to earlier on, you're going against an enemy that has very capable radar-guided SAMs, the SA-2 and 3 and 6 and 8, which had many of which had given the Israelis a great deal of trouble just 17 years earlier, and a very capable, primarily third-generation Air Force, but with some capable MiG-29 Fulcrum fourth-generation fighters that our pilots are going to have to contend with on night one. And that's the playing field that our airmen and aviators across the coalition were dealing with as we prepared to go to war.
And as if that wasn't enough, the weather showed up. Last night, Clouseau was talking about how right as they were about to take off, they're like, all right, there is thunderstorms in your air-to-air refueling block, which is what no aviator wants to hear right as you're about to take off on a combat mission, flying an hour just to get to the tanker before you start your combat mission. So the weather was very concerning. There was a thought at the Air Operations Center that they might lose dozens of aircraft in midair collisions, just refueling because of the weather. I was about to say famously, at least maybe famously for us air power nerds, there's an anecdote in Halyan's book where he talks about Glossin asked Horner as they're sitting watching all their screens, how many aircraft do you think we're going to lose? And supposedly Horner on a piece of paper wrote down the number 42. That was the number of aircraft he thought that they might lose on night one, which is well below historic norms. But when we look back, that would have been, I guess, devastating. And when we're talking about expelling the ghosts of Vietnam, something like that, you know, had we had those kinds of losses, I think that this whole thing and the support for Desert Storm may not have happened the way it did. We needed a blowout victory, and we got that. So, you know, when, and this is another, just one more reason why I hate this thought about us just beating up on the weakling. There was a significant concern that we were going to lose a lot of airplanes, not through poor equipment or poor tactics and training, but just fog and friction of war and a pretty well-equipped adversary. And that's not exactly how it went down. So first night, 668 sorties. There would eventually be 2,500 sorties in the first 24-hour period. The first 3 days were scripted. But that first night was, there's all kinds of things that we're going to talk about on night one. But of those nearly 700 sorties, it was the U.S., the Royal Air Force, France, Saudi Arabia doing a lot of the heavy lifting. The mission began actually early morning on the 16th, 0636 in the morning. Seven B-52s took off from Barksdale Air Force Base on a 14,000-mile road trip mission from Barksdale to the Persian Gulf, where they were going to launch some of their air-launched cruise missiles or ALCMs. That is just amazing. We now know these as global strike missions, but they were going to launch these cruise missiles at critical targets. So that's when it really kicks off. But what we think about with the first shooters are, is Task Force Normandy. I know this was your requirement in order for me to get you on the pod. So go. I'm going to hand it over to you to talk about Task Force Normandy.
Well, we'll start with the objective. So in the context of John Warden's strategy and ultimately General Horner's air campaign, we wanted and needed bombs to be on Baghdad, on the C2 and the national leadership on night one. In order to safely and effectively get bombs on the leadership in night one, we were planning to use, first and foremost, F-117s, which are low observable, not no observable platforms, as we found out quite famously 8 years later in Serbia. And in order to delay detection and prevent the Iraqi integrated air defense system kill chain from getting completed, it was critical to take out two early warning sites in southwestern Saudi Arabia, approximately 70 miles apart, not very far past the Saudi-Iraqi border, actually. And there were really two missions that took place under the TF Normandy banner. Each of those mission sets included two MH-53 Pavlos, which had this really relatively new technology called GPS and really kick-ass terrain following and terrain avoidance radars. And they would be the guides for four Apaches. So you had two packages of two Pavlos and two AH-64 Apaches going after each of the early warning sites that were targeted initially. And those particular missions were a raging success. The Pavlos got the Apaches within a few hundred meters of their target. At that point, they went to a predetermined loiter point. The Apaches did the Lord's work. The Hellfire missile had not seen extensive combat experience in the American military up until this point. Raging success for those munitions and by those Apache pilots. Early warning radar sites taken out. A 20-mile gap created in the southwesterly portion of the Iraqi early warning air defenses, and that created a pocket where, first and foremost, those F-117s and then follow-on sorties could get into the Iraqi airspace and start doing God's work. Again, the F-117s going after the critical nodes in Baghdad, but we had a variety of non-low observable aircraft striking targets across southern and central Iraq that night.
Yeah, when I used to teach this, as a good football analogy, I think, I mean, this is like a couple of offensive linemen that just pancake their D linemen, open up a huge hole for the running back. And in this case, that's the F-117s. And then you get a ton of strikers that follow in behind once you've opened that gap, including some Strike Eagles that were hitting some Scuds or hitting some airfields. A bunch of stuff is getting hit in western central Iraq after this happens. But the key there is to get the F-117s in. So the F-117s had a little bit of combat experience in Panama. It wasn't particularly a very successful mission, but this is the first real scaled test of this low observable technology. And as you mentioned, low observable does not mean stealth, and you need to protect your low observable platforms. And the ways that you can do that is knock out critical radars. You can also jam certain radars, but you gotta give them a little bit of help. And the intent was those F-117s get in. They were the only manned aircraft that were allowed over downtown Baghdad. So you've got some air-launched cruise missiles from the B-52s. You got Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles, or TLAMs, that are coming off of a bunch of ships in the now Arabian Gulf, known at the time as the Persian Gulf. And they're hitting some critical targets as well. But the laser-guided bombs that are coming out of those F-117s are hitting the critical targets. So General Horner's description of what he wanted to do on night one, I think, puts it better than either you or I are going to say. He said the intent was to blind the enemy air defense system and isolate the elements from the brain. Thus, it's no longer a system, but individual weapons operating in the dark. The intent of these F-117s is once they start hitting some of the Kari IADS nodes that we talked about, then it makes everybody else a little bit less lethal because they are not communicating across the country. They're not getting the national air picture. And when they are isolated, they're both less deadly. They're also easier to destroy. And this all works together. So you have Task Force Normandy opening the door. You have the F-117s coming through. And stealth that day worked really well, in large part because we did such a good job of force packaging. There's no aircraft loss, of course, for the F-117s throughout the entire, at least this combat or this war. They get to Baghdad and they drop on some critical targets. I think my favorite story here is hitting the communications building, which had been dubbed the AT&T building. So as much money as we put into our National Military Command Center at the Pentagon or the Air Operations Center at Riyadh, our battle damage assessment wasn't being done by satellites or anything like that. It was being done by CNN. We knew that if we were successful, that CNN would go off the air at right around 3 o'clock when the first bombs were supposed to drop, because one of the first targets was the Iraqi communications node in downtown Baghdad, which we called the AT&T building. So they're watching the TV, they're hearing Wolf and the gang, you know, talking about air raid sirens going off, and we're seeing a bunch of tracers go up, and then all of a sudden CNN goes out. And as the story goes, you get a kind of a roar in the AOC as they know that they have hit the targets, that the stealth has worked, everything has worked as planned. A couple of quotes. Warden says, supposedly, he's quoted, this night, right after this happens at 3:01 when the TV goes off, he says, the war is over. We won. Sorry, not Horner. This is Warden. Sorry, in the National Military Command Center. But he says, the war is over. We won. There is nothing now the Iraqis can do to prevent us from exercising our military will upon them. That is 60 seconds into the campaign. Now, that is Warden, again, maybe getting a little bit out in front of his skis. But nonetheless, he knows that the plan that he played a major role in developing has worked. And now it is really going to be tough for the Iraqis to put up a really strong defense, because we've eliminated a lot of the ways for them to put up that strong defense. And Hallian himself says, by the time dawn broke in the morning of the 17th, Iraq was well on the way to losing the war, thanks to the coalition strategic air campaign. We'll talk a little bit about air superiority, but those are the main strategic strikes of night one. In 2003, we call night one shock and awe. I think it was sort of dull and disappointing compared to the shock and awe that I think a lot of us felt on night one of Desert Storm.
Yeah, the Iraqis were, some people were surprised, some analysts were surprised that the Iraqi Air Force wasn't more aggressive even in 1991. After the first week, it's understandable why they were not, even I guess the first 96 hours, you could argue. Based on that experience, 12 years later, they're burying their fighter jets in the sand, and their radar, most of their early warning radar and virtually all of their air defense operators, SAM operators, are afraid to even turn their radars on. That's part of the legacy of American air power across the joint force and our coalition.
It is the epitome. And when we talk about the lessons that can be learned, I think these are some of the things that we need to talk about. Now, one of the concerns I think that people have today in talking about contemporary air power is that we think too much along the way that we did the rollback of their integrated air defense system, and that today's adversaries have built in a little bit more resiliency, and it's probably not going to happen as easy as it did then. And I think there is some validity to that. However, I still think the underpinnings are the same. If you can isolate the adversary, and we have different means of doing that, you don't necessarily need to rely on stealth anymore. You could apply a cyber effect or multi-domain effects. But I still think that some of the critical lessons there is, if you can blind and isolate the adversary, you are going to make them less lethal, and you are going to maximize our ability to find and kill them.
It was not a foregone conclusion, either theoretically or operationally, that going after command and control nodes or battle management nodes is necessarily should necessarily be the priority of a military campaign. And there are still a variety of people, particularly outside the Air Force, who don't necessarily agree with that perspective. But as an airman and a student of history, of military history, I would submit to you that regardless of the domain, regardless of the enemy, that the more you can, as Warden put it, kill the brain and drive the weapon systems to an autonomous state, the more effective you're going to be. And that's, again, across all domains. And it's something that I think we need to take away from Desert Storm going forward.
So air superiority, in the at least next episode, as the listeners hear it, but the interview I did last night, I talk a lot about air superiority. So we're not going to spend a ton of time on air superiority, but there's no way that we are not going to talk a little bit about air superiority, as both alumni of the 33rd Fighter Wing, that at least at the time had the 58th Fighter Squadron Mighty Gorillas and the 60th Fighting Crows. We got to talk a little bit about air superiority. And so when we were at Eglin, and I'm sure that legacy still is on in the F-35 unit that is there now, the 16 kills of the Gorillas and the 18 overall kills of the 33rd Fighter Wing, by far the most of any unit in Desert Storm. I mean, those were legendary. I mean, we knew the names, we knew the shoot downs, we watched some of the heads up display video. Those were things that we have studied a lot. Overall, the coalition was 36-0 and 43-0 if you count helicopters. I put a little asterisk there. For some reason, we still don't count the Navy Lieutenant Scott Spiker shoot down from a MiG-25, which has been proven now. We still don't count that. But let's go ahead and call it a 43-1 kill ratio. The Eagles did the bulk of the work, especially in the first few nights. But air superiority, like you mentioned, it didn't take that long. So night one, we had 6 kills. JB Kelk, he's a mighty gorilla MiG killer. He was the one that got the first kill of the war. And there were 6 kills on the first few hours of the war. And then the Iraqis kind of took a little bit of time to take a break and kind of collect themselves. And they flew again on the 19th, and it got ugly for them on the 19th. And a whole bunch more kills. And by that point, they had lost 14 aircraft within the first 48 to 72 hours of the conflict. And really, by that point, air superiority was established just 3 days into the war. And by the 26th, the decision had been made after they took basically a week off. Our best chance of survival is not to fly towards the Americans. It's to fly to our bitter enemy, Iran, and fly our Air Force there. Just amazing, the air superiority campaign. But again, by no means a guarantee. They were a combat-proven force with very, very impressive aircraft, to include the MiG-29 and the French F-1. What do you take out of the air superiority fight?
Yeah, pretty staggering. Absolutely not a foregone conclusion. So in the early days of the war, the first week of the campaign, we've got our RAF partners flying GR4s 100 or 200 feet off the deck, sometimes 50 feet off the deck, bombing the airfields. At the same time, rolling in, right, we've got God's Jet and the C-Model Eagle setting up reset caps, just clubbing those Iraqi pilots like baby seals if they are able to take off. And then the next layer out, our Vipers employing the AGM 88 to go after any air defenses that might be radiating on the ground. And really, the packaging air power in this realm was the culmination of what had been discussed on your first podcast, Gorilla, in terms of Operation Bolo. And
you're listening. Thank
just
you.
A foregone conclusion, right? And putting really smartly integrating suppression of any air defenses, air superiority, and precision strike all together. And that wasn't necessarily the case how air power was packaged before. It made its debut in Vietnam and really, in my judgment, really hit its stride in Desert Storm.
And of course, command and control, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, the glue that kind of makes this all happen. And Clouseau, when you hear his story, we'll talk a lot about awesome AWACS controllers that were given great, important call-outs at the time. And I think what's also really important, you hit on it, kind of seems like a couple hours ago now, because we've been talking about this for a little while, was the decentralized execution, the trust that we put in our pilots, the training that we gave them. They were better able to handle, much better able to handle the fog and friction of war than the Iraqis were. And that turned out very poorly for the Iraqi Air Force. And within just a couple of days, they were not able to put up any realistic fight. And they still had tons. And I mean, they had hundreds of frontline combat aircraft, but there was no point in flying them. It was just, you know, throwing lives away at that point because they were not going to be able to survive. With an eight ship of Eagles in the west, an eight ship of Eagles in the center and or in the central part of the country, and then eight more Langley Eagles out on the east side. If it flew, it was pretty much dying, and that became pretty clear after the sorties on the 19th of January. I think what's the last thing that I would say about air superiority is shooting down airplanes is really cool, but that is not an end to an operation. That is actually just the beginning. It is the means that we do everything else. And so I talked about in the planning of the air campaign that the four phases were not really phased, at least in time. The first three happened pretty much simultaneously. And the reason why they happened that way was because air superiority was established from our air-to-air platforms, from our suppression of enemy air defense and the strikers. Once there is the Iraqis lose the ability to defend themselves, for the most part, not to say we didn't lose aircraft and there wasn't risk, but once we have done that, then you can get to the other three or the three phases. So not just air superiority, but the strategic campaign, the attacks on the fielded forces. So we know that Schwarzkopf wants to get to 50% attrition of ground forces. You don't now have to wait for all these things to happen. You can start going after them on day two and three, which is exactly what happened. So air superiority, big thumbs up as something that went really, as good as we probably could have hoped. There's a whole lot of reasons why that happened. Tactics, training, better equipment, it all kind of converged into what happened in the first week of Desert Storm. Now, looking at the other end of the coin, something that didn't work out nearly as well is the Great Scud Hunt. So the Scud is a surface-to-surface missile, a strategic weapon that the Iraqis wanted to use for a couple things. First, impose costs on the U.S. and its allies. And the second, which when we look at the grand strategy of Iraq, I think actually made a lot of sense. Saddam wanted to bring Israel into the war. So he thought if he could launch Scuds at Israel, they would retaliate. And having Iraq in the air campaign or in the ground campaign, either way, whatever, that would start to splinter the Arab alliance and cause problems for our being able to have our forces in the Gulf Coalition countries. And it would just cause a bunch of problems for the overall campaign. So there was a good reason to try and launch the Scuds. And they started early. They launched a couple of Scuds into Israel on the 17th of January. And this very quickly caused the air planners to really change around their plan. And they started allocating up to 48 sorties a day to going out over the sands of the western Iraqi desert looking for Scud launchers, nearly 2,500 sorties over the course of the air campaign, just looking for Scuds. And the reason why I say it wasn't particularly effective and there's no real good number on how many we actually killed. Some people will tell you we didn't actually kill any and that we only killed decoys. I think the number is somewhere in the low single digits of Scud launchers that were actually destroyed. Iraqis were very good, used a lot of denial and deception, shoot and scoot tactics. They would launch and within minutes they'd be on the road again. Now lot of really good employment in trying to find these Scud launchers. We were using JSTARS, or that we'll talk about a little bit later. We're using our command and control and intelligence assets. We had U.S. and very famously U.K. special operators on the ground that were searching for them, and that was our probably best success, is some of the U.K. special operators finding some of these for us. So, Slam, what can we learn from the great Scud hunt of 1991?
It's actually one of the few parts, perhaps, of the Desert Storm campaign that I think actually has some parallels and some values to the post 9/11 counterinsurgency world. And that is to say, keeping pressure on your target has value, even if you don't necessarily find and or destroy your target. The Scuds had to keep moving. They couldn't necessarily employ at the time and place of their choosing. And by keeping pressure on those Scud units, I think we reduced either the effectiveness of their timing and or the overall number of launches they were able to make. By anyone's estimate who's looked at this campaign closely, we were not terribly successful in taking a lot of Scuds off the battlefield.
But the effect, yep. And we'll yep. see some of the effect in a yep. similar way with the suppression of enemy air defenses, is that according to Hallion, the Iraqis were launching 5 missiles a day for the first 10 days, down to 1 a day the last 33 days of the campaign. So we're not killing a bunch of launchers, but we've cut 80% into their amount of launches. That is having an effect. Absolutely. So the campaign was effective on that front. The effects were there, but we were not all that successful in being able to find these launchers.
And that goes to the age old problem that I think the Air Force continues to struggle with mightily. And that is assessment, right? Measures of performance versus measure of effectiveness, not just a reduction number of launches. I don't have an empirical evidence, but I suspect that when an Iraqi Scud unit in early 1991 did stop to launch, they didn't do as much normal preparation as they would in terms of trying to posture for an accurate, you know, relatively accurate Scud launch, as much as those ballistic missiles could be accurately targeted. So they clearly had an effect. And that's one lesson learned we should take away, that the Air Force and Air Forces across the U.S. and our coalition partners need to keep learning is really being smart with how we do assessment.
Yep, and this problem set is not going away. Mobile missiles are even more of a problem than they were in 1991. And you name the conflict that we could potentially be in as a coalition force. Finding, fixing, and finishing mobile missiles is always going to be a problem. But I think you made a good point. They were doing the shooting and scooting. They're not spending a lot of time preparing to launch these things. And for the most part, incredibly inaccurate. They didn't always fuse, and they had one real lucky shot, a Scud that hit a U.S. Army barracks in Dhahran on February the 25th. Just happened to be normally scheduled Patriot maintenance, that Patriot battery that was designed to protect that barracks or that location, not active. That missile got through. 28 American soldiers were killed, 97 additional wounded. So a horribly tragic day that tried to get at the strategic effect that they wanted for launching the Scuds. But I think the fact that we were able to keep the Israelis out of the conflict, keep the coalition together, and keep the number of casualties relatively limited, I think speaks a lot to the campaign. So I think there's both goods and bads that you can take out of the Great Scud Hunt.
Violently agree. And you can make an argument that road mobile ballistic missiles, and I would say road mobile missiles in general, are the biggest and most important challenge for Air Force and American intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance going forward. It's in the discussion.
Absolutely. So now let's get into some of the attacks on fielded forces. So really, we've been spending a lot of time talking about week one, but this is a 42-plus day air campaign, including the support for the ground forces in phase four. And it's tough to really think about things that you want to talk about. I've just picked attacks on tanks, known at the time as tank plinking, the Battle of Kafji, and then the ground war and the Highway of Death. So we'll start with tank plinking, which great story from Clouseau yesterday. Apparently, General Horner hated the term tank plinking. So all of the wing commanders knew this and told their pilots, hey guys, the boss doesn't want you calling it tank plinking to ensure that it forever would be called tank plinking by the air crew, which I thought was hilarious. So, yeah, tank plinking. And I know somewhere in my notes, I had some quotes here that I was going to read from some Iraqi generals that were captured. But one of them, and I'll just paraphrase because I can't find that note, was they said that in the Iran-Iraq war, the tank was his friend and they would sleep in the tank. And in this war, the tank was, they had to get as far away from it at night because it was very liable to be blown up. There's a couple of primary aircraft, the A-10 really proved itself. And we'll of course talk a lot more about it during the ground campaign, but with the Maverick missile, you know, one shot, one kill on tons and tons of tanks, and then the B-52 and its psychological effect. But I can't even imagine what it would be like to be under the withering attack of a buff.
This was a mesh point for precision guided munitions and general purpose bombs that really had some value, right? So we had a relatively small inventory of PGMs. And there's something to be said when you're fighting a major combat operation with open fielded forces for a shitload of GP bombs. So you can read, in fact, I believe this is going open source, any individual who's interested can read Iraqi POW and defector reports on their perspective when they heard the buffs after the first couple nights of getting dropped on by GP bombs, of just literally shitting their pants when hearing the buffs. And here come God knows how many Mark 82s on your unit coming out of that B-52. So when you're fighting a fielded force, sometimes the simple things have an effect. And Guerrilla, you brought up a question, things we can learn going forward as we move to a more complex and integrated and networked force. There is a role for simplicity and non-networked weapons that don't necessarily have some of the vulnerabilities that our more high-end precision-guided network weapons have. They both have a role going forward in terms of how we design our combat power.
So you're saying not every target needs a million-dollar plus weapon?
Correct. Yes. All right. Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
So I got to talk tank plinking. I'm going to hand over the Battle of Kafji to you, 29th through 31st of January. Iraq does a very small scale invasion of Saudi Arabia. Really still, we're not sure exactly why. Take the initiative back, do something to change up. I mean, at this point, it's been 2 weeks of getting beat up on, and Saddam orders this small scale invasion. And it, you know, didn't turn out so well for him.
No, I think Saddam still wants a bloody battle that maybe can turn the American public opinion and world public opinion against continuing this campaign further. And at this point in his mind, he is trying to achieve some sort of stalemate for this campaign going forward. Kafji is, again, predominantly on the American side, fought by Marines. There are some soldiers there as well, but it's the big point is it's an Iraqi incursion into Saudi Arabia. And that was, I think, Saddam's mind, trying to get some leverage and relieve some pressure on all the different trigger points that he was suffering under inside of Iraq. From an air campaign standpoint perspective, it is one of the, in my view, one of the most noblest engagements and events that's ever taken place in Air Force history. And that is one of our AC-130 gunships. Spirit 03 was the call sign of the AC-130 crew. So 14 crew members there. And for those not familiar, the AC-130 gunship is a magnificent killing machine that does a great deal of work for both special operations missions and support to conventional ground forces in the killing of the enemy on the ground. At Kafji, as is standard operating procedure for AC-130 gunships, the gunship is only safe operating at night if there's any sort of air defense threat. And as we've already discussed, the Iraqis had a robust tactical air defense threat and just thousands of man-portable air defense systems. As the sun was rising in Kafji on the morning of the 31st, The gunships were directed to leave while many of our Marines were still under heavy fire. The pilot in command made the decision, talked to his crew, but ultimately made the decision to stay on station as the sun was rising. And he had to know in his heart of hearts that this might end poorly, but it goes to the really the heart and the determination of that particular gunship crew. They stayed on station, delivering close air support for those Marines. Ultimately, they absorbed an SA, I believe it's an SA-14 or 16, in the belly of the aircraft in the center of the fuselage. Aircraft was lost. All 14 crew members were lost. No survivors in that particular engagement. Some have gone back in history and tried to, I apologize, I get a little bit emotional looking back at this event, be critical of the pilot for not departing the AO as the sun was rising. But I think you need to put yourself in the situation of the pilot in command, thinking about those troops on the ground. And
who were very close to being overrun. They were very close to being overrun.
And on the precipice of being overrun, where perhaps all those Marines die. And I respect the hell out of the pilot in command and his crew for staying on station, knowing that the risk they were taking was probably at the ludicrous scale.
And I think it's in any conflict, it's really important to hear some of those stories, especially one like this that was relatively bloodless on the coalition side. You have something like 135 total fatalities, and it is easy to say, you know, that's a huge, you know, huge victory, and it is. But each of those stories is terribly tragic. Later, we'll talk about a fratricide incident that killed 7. But you know, there's an event where 14 aviators lost their lives by being incredibly brave and fighting for those folks on the ground. And it's the kind of ethos that exists today with a lot of our different career fields, but certainly our battlefield airmen and those folks in the close air support career field or combat capability. And it's I think it's really important to hear. So terrible day for Spirit 03. And for the coalition, but again, I'm with you. I don't have a lot of time for the criticism of somebody that is there that is trying to save, you know, American lives and really coalition lives. So, kind of transitioning a little bit from that, the EAJ STAR is the Joint Surveillance Target Attack Radar System. This at the time was a pre-operational and basically still in test platform, had a side-looking radar that was able to identify ground movers, which now we kind of take as, you know, it just second nature that this happens, but that is new in 1991. That capability didn't even exist. There's still contractors that were flying on it, and talk about making its money. I mean, it was already had been thrown into the Great Scud Hunt. It was it was being used a lot, but they were able to identify divisions that were moving near the Kuwait-Saudi Arabia border and give the first indication that this might happen. And then as the Iraqi forces start streaming across the border, you get JSTARS that is providing the intelligence that it's happening. And then more importantly, giving the targeting information, and you get every platform that's got a bomb on it is being vectored to tanks, to armor, to artillery that is streaming across the border and putting the lives of these Marines in jeopardy. And they just maximize the killing power of our A-10s, of the Jaguars, of the Tornadoes. I mean, you name it, the Strike Eagles, all those aircraft are being vectored to huge columns of Iraqi armor. And they just do God's work, and they are taking those things off of the battlefield. And the JSTARS is another kind of unsung hero. So it's easy to talk about the F-15s, and you know, there's that show Dogfights that has a great CGI of those engagements. Not a whole lot of History Channel videos on the JSTARS, but they do some pretty awesome work at the time as well.
I know Colonel Dale Hebel will be extraordinarily pleased with this portion of the podcast.
Yeah. So, all right. A little bit of JSTARS. All right. Well, let's get into the ground campaign. So there's a lot of discussion about when we're going to transition into the air campaign or into the ground campaign. At the time of the development of the plan, There was the milestone of 50% of ground forces need to be attrited, or at least their armor attrited, so that we would open up the battlefield enough that we would let our ground forces go into Iraq or expel the Iraqis from Kuwait with less risk. This is one of those things that did not quite go quite right, is the battle damage assessment and trying to determine how much of Iraqi armor and Iraqi fielded forces were actually being attrited. And there's different numbers. The checkmate guys were saying 40%, air crew were saying higher than that. Some of the intelligence professionals at the Air Operations Center saying 15%. What it really came down to was Schwarzkopf talking to Horner and saying, you know, I don't know if we're going to get to this 50%. I don't know when we'll know for sure we're at 50%, but I've got a feeling. I think that we're there and that we have opened up the battlefield enough made it a little bit less risky for the forces to go in. And so he orders the ground campaign to begin on the 24th. And there's a lot here. So we've spent a whole pod, and I think I'm going to be breaking this one into two, talking about the air war. I'm sure that there is somebody at Leavenworth or Quantico that could do a couple of pods just on what happened in the ground war and some of the tank battles. But we'll talk a little bit about the air support to the ground war. This is close air support at its absolute finest, supporting a force that was on the move, moving probably faster than any ground force had ever moved and would ever move, at least until 2003. It turned out to be a relatively easy ground fight. Didn't mean there weren't some big battles, but the Iraqis had really lost the taste for battle. And I think a lot can be attributed to the air campaign.
And it goes back into the brief conversation we had there on measures of effectiveness versus performance. Whether or not we get to the 50% almost didn't matter, because you had huge percentages of the Iraqi army that were just unwilling or disinterested in fighting. And on the precision guided munition discussion, most of the time when observers talk about the sort of revolution in air power that came from PGMs, we focus on strategic targeting. My God, it has a huge role in close air support, and perhaps nowhere more is that evident than in the highway of death.
So Iraqi resistance collapsed pretty quickly. They had people that were surrendering by the tens of thousands. And a lot of those, like you talked about, you can hear or folks will talk about the sound of the B-52s and the fear that they had, knowing that the death was staring them in the face and that they were not ready to deal with what our ground forces were bringing and what we were bringing from the air. It doesn't take very long, and they start to eventually, so the war kicks off on the 24th. By the 26th, so less than 2 days in, the Iraqi forces begin to flee Kuwait, and they are headed north into Basra, and that road from Kuwait City into Basra is what ends up becoming the known as the Highway of Death. JSTARS, again, seeing huge columns of vehicles, starts to vector all of our ground attack aircraft to these fleeing Iraqis. And I'll hand it over to you to talk a little bit more about the Highway of Death.
So as we just alluded to, Guerrilla, the Maverick in particular, coming off the A-10 Warthog, was absolutely laying waste to Iraqi armor during the Iraqi retreat from Kuwait City. And this posed really the huge strategic question for the Bush administration and President Bush in particular, in terms of how far do we go with this campaign? Do we go and look to remove Saddam from power? Do we follow the Iraqi military all the way to the outskirts of Baghdad? And ultimately, in my judgment, to President George H.W. Bush's credit, he stuck, one, his UN Security Council mandate, and two, I think perhaps even more compelling for him, he was not willing to risk the lives of American and coalition service members over an objective that he didn't necessarily have in his heart of hearts of removing Saddam from power. They had been ejected from Kuwait. He met and didn't exceed his UN Security Council resolution mandate, and he was able to have a huge victory in Desert Storm with relatively minimal, again, if it's your dad or mom, it's it's everything, but relatively minimal casualties in that campaign. And I think he made a prudent choice to cease the campaign, not just for American casualties, but I suspect in a private moment, he and Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, saw what was happening to Iraqi military members and civilians during this campaign. And they thought it was the prudent move to cease operations based in large part based on the images coming out of the Highway of Death.
Yeah, not particularly easy images to look at. And the decision, I agree with you. There's going to be a lot of debate about that, you know, in the post 2003 timeframe was, should we have kept going to Baghdad? I think that was, you know, while we had the forces there, there's an argument to be made, but I agree with you that that exceeded the mandate. We had the victory that we were looking for. We expelled them from Kuwait. If didn't end Saddam's ability to his war making ability, certainly hindered it. And we saw it in 2003. He never truly was able to bring it back. And who knows what kind of conversation we would be having right now. You know, maybe we'd be talking about a 30-year insurgency had we expelled him. Who knows? The point was he had a UN mandate. He made the strategic level objectives, which is exactly, you know, going back to Clausewitz again. He has set the objectives and the military goes out and executes it, right? It's just it is a means for executing that policy. And that was done. So the war, 100 hours of the ground war. This is an area where I think air power advocates sometimes get themselves in a little bit of trouble is by overstating what the air campaign did. So I think the air campaign absolutely, was a force multiplier. It helped the ground campaign be relatively bloodless and be able to be a 100-hour ground campaign. But air power alone had not ejected the Iraqis from Kuwait. And this is where I think air power advocates are, they should certainly do a touchdown dance for what happened in the first 38 days of the air campaign. But we should not lose the sight picture of what air is, which is a very potent part of the joint force. And when you are planning a campaign, there's not going to be a lot of campaigns where you can just say air is going to win. It really needs to be a joint campaign.
Yep. Yeah. Violent agreement there. And I hope that what Desert Storm did, and I think what Desert Storm did, even in the mind of a lot of Marine and Army leaders, is that we can have strategic objectives. We can strike deep objectives on night one, day one, or early in a campaign, even understanding that for most of the campaigns that we engage, particularly at sort of the theater level, that it's going to require ground force to go in and ultimately do the job. And as an airman, I fully embrace that perspective. We bring a hell of a capability to the joint force, but in most circumstances, air power will not be successful on its own. The allied force is sort of this anomaly in U.S. military history, in my view.
Don't get too ahead of ourselves. We do have an allied force podcast coming up in the future. But so it is easy to talk about the F-117, the F-15, the A-10. I'm sure the Royal Air Force on their pods will be talking about the Tornado. I think some of the things that are left on the cutting room floor sometimes are talking about supporting capabilities and some of the things that we don't typically talk as much about because maybe they're not as sexy a mission as shooting down MiGs. So there are a couple supporting capabilities that I really want to talk about. The first, not really a capability, it is a little bit bigger than that, is the coalition that we were able to bring together. And really, we set kind of the model for how we're going to fight wars going into the 21st century. And that's certainly how we fought. It's not U.S. alone. So what are some things from the coalition in terms of the capacity or capability that they brought that stand out to you in this campaign?
Between my two squadron command tours, I had the privilege to serve 8 months at a Combined Joint Task Force Operation Inherent Resolve, 70 countries involved. I think the Desert Storm experience and the positive results of Desert Storm laid a foundation for coalition warfare that is almost impossible to measure, but which I value a great deal. That is to say, because of the staggering success of Desert Storm, and I would argue because we didn't overreach or go beyond our UN mandate, we had believe, 70 partners in the OIR coalition. Success breeds buy-in and additional support. Our coalition partners bring different skill sets and capabilities. Yeah. The political support is as important as the military support, but moving forward into the future where American military power, I think beyond, this is a statement of fact, is in relative decline across the world, where we were going to rely on our allies more and more. Having buy-in is the first step. And then we just, I believe, need to integrate our allies more effectively in sort of longer term planning in terms of who is going to bring what capability to the table and how are the various capabilities going to be integrated as we go fight.
Great points, actually, at even a more strategic level than I was planning on talking about. I was going to go into the pieces and parts of the different capacity and capability, but I think you really, really hit the nail on the head. This set the groundwork, this set the roadmap for how future coalition operations are going to be done. And we've seen it over the last 30 years to varying levels of success. But nonetheless, I don't think the failure has been with the coalition. We saw a bunch of different air forces in particular that we're talking here that provided different things. So it was important to have some of the Arab coalition that was, or the Arab countries in the coalition. Certainly the Saudi Air Force had a lot of skin in the game. They got a couple of, kills in their Saudi F-15s. We had France and Canada and Italy, and probably our, you know, our most special relationship, the Royal Air Force, did absolutely unbelievable work in terms of some of those unique capabilities, those tornado airfield attacks. They brought a ton of capacity on air-to-air refueling in terms of the suppression of enemy air defense fight. They brought the air-launched anti-radiation missile or alarm, played a huge role. The tornadoes, they suffered a lot. 13% of the aircraft that they brought were shot down of that deployed fleet. A lot of it was they had low altitude tactics that they were doing. But you know, without getting into too much, we could spend a lot of time talking about what each of these services brought. I think it's important to know that when you're looking at how you're going to integrate an ally or a coalition, is look at what capacity are they bringing and where can we leverage them. I think air-to-air refueling is a perfect example. Most of our partners that are bringing air-to-air refuelers, it's not a unique capability, it's just extra capacity. And then maybe some of the capability. Nobody was doing airfield attacks better than the tornadoes were. And so leverage them to do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And they trained for it. Their doctrine focused on that to a large extent. You mentioned the J-STARS. The Brits, I'm not going to get too much into the name or details of the platform because I'm not entirely sure on the classification levels, but they have a similar platform that actually has enhanced capabilities, both in terms of platform and sensor performance. So we gained so much from our coalition partners. It's hard to overstate both politically and militarily.
So we're both intelligence professionals. The next thing, the command, control, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, space, played a huge role and certainly does not get enough credit. And we're not trying to take the credit from the air superiority community, certainly did great work, but a lot in particular, this is really, I feel like a coming out party for space-based platforms and capabilities.
This is a quote from a pilot, not from an intel officer. Air power is targeting. Targeting is intelligence, right? You can have PGMs, you can have a strategic campaign, you can have your five rings. If you don't know what to hit based on rigorous intelligence preparation of the battlefield, and then based on your collection of those high value targets, knowing it's the right time to hit those targets, you're ultimately not going to be as successful as you otherwise would be with your strategic or operational level air campaign. Intelligence, both in the planning phase and in real time or near real time collection, support to operations, and in the battle damage assessment that you've already talked a lot about, Guerrilla, is absolutely pivotal to air power effectiveness. At the end of the day, it's about pilots and air crew putting effects on objectives, but identifying those objectives and understanding whether we were successful or not is driven largely by intelligence professionals and facilitated by air battle managers and space professionals.
So you mentioned the Bolo episode. One of my takeaways from Operation Bolo was the integration of intelligence for mission planning and then also within the mission. And I think there is a huge step up from 1967 in Operation Bolo to what you have in 1991 here, which is the doors of the vault were opened. We weren't hiding information from pilots or air crew because it was too sensitive. That intelligence was being given to planners. It was being utilized by the wings that were deployed, and they were ready. And I think it was pretty clear that, and this is not to say we didn't make some mistakes. Of course, there's always going to be some mistakes. But I think intelligence from the strategic to the tactical level makes a huge leap forward between Vietnam and Desert Storm. And Warden, while he was back in D.C., he was leveraging his contacts within the intelligence community to help out with target development before the war, to help out with battle damage assessment during the war. I think all that is important. And now, in terms of intelligence to the cockpit, it is light years ahead of where we were in Bolo in terms of getting real-time signals, intercepts into the cockpit to get tactical or space-based and imagery to the folks that need it. Just a huge improvement in the way that intelligence supported the battlefield. And then from the space-based perspective, space was huge here. So satellite navigation was in its infancy. I mean, you talked about this new fangled device, the GPS, the global positioning system. Like, how would we live if we didn't have that anymore? Satellite communications, missile warning actually was huge. So missile warning initially from space, initially designed to identify ICBMs that were being launched over the poles to protect America,
could and be weather, used for, which you brought up.
Yeah, and then weather, exactly. So all these are space-based capabilities that I see space, especially space is so hot right now, to quote Derek Zoolander, or actually to quote Zoolander. But space played a big role in 91. Suppression of enemy air defenses. I mean, boy, we could talk a lot about that. And we kind of rolled that up into air superiority, which I consider it the same. But a plethora of aircraft, the EF-111, Spark Vark, maybe one of the greatest names of an aircraft, 4G, F-16, the Tornado, the Jaguar, everybody playing a little bit of a role. And the Iraqis learned pretty quickly, you don't turn the radar on. You turn the radar on, you're probably going to die. And like you mentioned, they didn't turn it on in 2003 either. They learned their lesson.
Devastating effects, and which I'm always guilty of when talking about air power in general and Desert Storm in particular, the role played by both the Navy and the Marine Corps, aviation beyond the coalition, obviously immense. And you address the loss of Commander Spiker there, and then you alluded to it, but I think it's important to call out when you talk about American and coalition air power, the most undervalued capability is air-to-air refueling. It is taken as a matter of fact. We just assume it away. It is an extraordinary capability that this campaign would not have been possible without.
And the last group of unsung heroes, the maintainers. So throughout the entire war, the U.S. Air Force had a greater than 85% mission capability rate on their aircraft, which is better than what you get at home. And terrible weather, there were sandstorms, and these aircraft were being flown hard, and they were being turned. And there were no missions that were being turned back to the Air Operations Center because wings did not have the aircraft available. They were able to get those aircraft flying with, you know, whatever MacGyver stuff they had to do to get those airplanes flying. And definitely, you don't get to read about them much. I mean, they're kind of thrown in at the end of some of these books, just like they're being thrown into this podcast. But I think it's really important to realize it's not just the folks wearing flight suits that did really good work in this conflict. So I'm sure upset some folks because we didn't talk about their favorite thing, right? Had I missed Task Force Normandy, you would have lost it. I'm sure we've missed something that we're going to hear about on social media, and that's fine. But I just wanted to end this fairly lengthy conversation with what went right, what went wrong. So I'll give you the first draft pick. What do you think went right in this conflict?
So the integration of precision-guided munitions into theater strategy. That was, if I were to take one thing away from an air power perspective, I think that was a revolutionary change. And it's something the whole world took note of. And it has changed how air forces plan for air campaigns, how they acquire weapons, and what they think about going to war with the United States would look like. The integration of PGMs into a theater-level campaign had absolutely staggering effects on the battlefield, and that legacy continues on to this day.
That's awesome. One of the things that I put in my notes here that Howian says right at the end is he does the comparison of what a precision-guided munition-equipped aircraft can do in Desert Storm versus World War II. One aircraft carrying two precision-guided munitions, just as an example, could destroy a power generation station. In World War II, to get the same effect, you need two entire B-17 combat wings, 108 combat aircraft, dropping 648 bombs, and 1,080 airmen at risk. Whoa, you talk about inverting the cost and the risk curve, right? And that is precision-guided munitions. I'll take the low-hanging fruit here, stealth. It's kind of rolled into the precision-guided munitions. We had a feeling it was going to work, until you actually get home from that first mission and got home safely, we didn't know exactly what this technology was going to do. And it was a game changer. And it was a game changer for a long time. Now, certainly some of our adversaries have started to make some strides in ways to detect and engage stealth. And they've come up with their own stealth platforms. But low observability proved itself in spades in Desert Storm. So I'll give you the next pick. What else went right?
Let's say integration of the joint force. As I suspect most people listening to this podcast are familiar with the failings of Desert One in Iran at the end of the Carter administration and the struggles with joint interoperability on Granada at Operation Urgent Fury, which we started to see some improvements at El Dorado Canyon, at Libya, and Just Cause in Panama. And to me, after the failures of joint interoperability at times in Vietnam and certainly in Iran and at Grenada, we saw that culmination is the wrong word, but we certainly saw a change in terms of how the services were able to fight together. I won't say that congressional act again to deny some Desert Storm bingo players, Guerrilla, but we became a joint force, really, perhaps for the first time during this campaign in a way that we weren't before.
I think you can even go, so of course, joint coalition as well. Unbelievable the way that we were able to bring a coalition together. Doesn't mean there wasn't interoperability problems. Doesn't mean there wasn't comm problems. Same thing on the joint. I mean, we had to fly out the air tasking order to carriers. So, wouldn't say we had it nailed, right? But we made big strides on the joint and coalition side. And I'll just end, and I'm sure we're missing some other things that went right with the fighter modernization. Of course, the Mighty Mighty Eagle, the F-15, the F-16, the A-10, all of these aircraft making their first large-scale presence in combat operations in Desert Storm. Looks like you wanted to say one other thing.
One more thing, Gitter, and it's from an air-minded perspective, it almost seems obvious in hindsight, but the operational approach in TTPs for taking down IADs, that is using both electronic warfare and kinetic effects to, like I say, gouge out the eyes of the IADs, early warning, also using electronic warfare and kinetic effects to rip out the tongue of the IADs from a command and control standpoint, and then using...
How far are we going with this analogy?
anti-radiation missiles for seed and PGMs for the destruction of air defenses to sort of kick the IADs right where it hurts in terms of going after weapons control. And after this campaign, we had a very valuable template to apply to integrate air defense system threats going forward.
Yeah.
Apologize for being too graphic.
No, I will say the last thing, improved tactics and training. So my favorite period to read about and study in U.S. Air Force history is that post-Vietnam era, the improvement in the fighter weapons school, the development of Operation Red Flag, the development of the aggressors, the constant peg program to fly MiGs, all of those things, it's the convergence. So you know, F-15 is important, but if you don't know how to employ that F-15 in a large force employment with all those other capabilities and supporting assets we talked about, there's a lot more on the what went right than what went wrong. But as weapons officers, I think it would be we'd be missing our job if we didn't talk a little bit about what we didn't do well as a joint and coalition force. So there's three things, at least, that I identified, and you can either amplify or let me know if there's anything else that you think that didn't go wrong. The first was fratricide. Fratricide is always going to remain an issue, and it has continued to remain an issue in the conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. But 24% of U.S. fatalities, 35 of them, were based on friendly fire incidents, led to things like Blue Force Tracker, GPS helps. There's other things that have helped, but we certainly haven't eliminated it. And Clouseau talked a lot in his air-to-air engagement story about making sure that they were identifying it. It is a huge thing in the air superiority community. And unfortunately, they'll just a few years later in Northern Watch have a very, very sad fratricide incident. So we certainly haven't eliminated that, but that was a major, major problem. The Scud hunt, I think we've sold as both a positive and a negative. We certainly, the effects were good in that just like suppression of enemy air defenses, you don't need to destroy everything. If you get them to turn off a radar, then you've been successful. If you get a Scud launcher to hide under a highway overpass and not shoot, you've been successful. That said, I think there's a lot we can learn in terms of how we find, fix, and kill these things. And we certainly didn't do enough of that. And then the last, I would say, and maybe the thing that we've made the biggest improvement on would be combat search and rescue. CSAR only picked up 3 of 64 downed air crew in Desert Storm. Now, a lot of that is that folks were being shot down well behind enemy lines, and it was just too risky to pick folks up. That said, one of the things that went wrong was the CSAR assets were being double tapped to support Special Operations Forces and CSAR. It is tough when you have two different operational missions and one takes a lot more time because of the taskings, which would be Special Operations Forces. I really think we've had a dedicated combat search and rescue force since then. And certainly with all the talk and execution of the golden hour and getting folks on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan to medical support within 60 minutes, the survival rate is so much higher. I think we made huge strides since Desert Storm in our CSAR. So those are three things I saw that maybe we could do a little bit better.
Tactically, I have very little to nitpick with the warriors who wage this campaign. Operationally, even there, I'm grasping at straws a little bit. Perhaps part of the targeting and BDA campaign, not thinking about the effects beyond CNN going out that particular night, but the effect of the 24-hour news cycle on the campaign. And you alluded to it with CSAR, right? What's going to happen from a propaganda standpoint when our pilots get captured? But that, again, is much more sort of the operational and strategic perspective. By and large, when I look at Desert Storm in hindsight, hell, in the moment, I view it as a raging success. There are always lessons learned that the various subject matter experts, I'm sure, can pull out from this campaign. But there are times that we need to say, hey, things went largely right. And we need to say what lessons learned on the positive side can we take going forward?
So that leads me into my last couple of questions, and I'll let you go so we can watch some playoff football. Was air power decisive, and maybe do we have we overstated? I think we've kind of already argued that I don't think we believe that we have overemphasized the success of Desert Storm, but that question is out there. Have we overemphasized the success of Desert Storm and taken the wrong lessons learned because we beat up on a weakling?
A couple things. In terms of the campaign, it was necessary, wildly capable, but not sufficient in achieving victory as defined by the UN Security Council and the Bush administration. So very necessary, wildly successful, but not sufficient as a component of the joint and coalition force. This was a robust threat. They may have been, depending who you, what analyst you subscribe to, were somewhere between the 5th and 10th most capable military in the world. It is not the fault of the coalition or the Americans who fought in that campaign that our weaponry, tactics, and plan was far superior to theirs. So it's not something that we should have to apologize for, and we should embrace the success that came out of that campaign. And to me, if there's any measure of success and feedback we should take, look at how some of our greatest adversaries responded to American success in that campaign. If we were just kicking down the door on some weakling, why did it shape the doctrine, policy, and acquisition on the military side for China, for Russia, to a lesser extent for North Korea, for That's Syria, for others, yeah. right? So if we were just, again, kicking down the doors on little Panama, it wouldn't have changed the entire military-industrial complex for all of those very powerful countries going forward. So I believe this was a massive success strategically, operationally, and tactically, and we can take a lot of great lessons learned. And by God, we should be able to throw one back and celebrate it a little bit as well.
You beat the team that's in front of you. You know, Ohio State shouldn't be penalized, and this one's for Slider Kerr, shouldn't be penalized for having to play Illinois, right? I mean, that's who's there, right? You beat who's in front of you, and that's what we did. Okay, last question. What can we take for future peer or regional conflicts? I wrote down a couple of notes. I'll see if you have anything. We're going to want air superiority, all right? You need that. It is a necessary first step. Interoperability with the coalition partners. We got to keep bringing them to Red Flag. We got to go to their exercises. It's not just the equipment. It's the ability to communicate. It's tactics. Multi-domain operations. It is the buzzword. It's so hot right now. We were doing multi-domain operations then as well. So we were using space. We didn't have cyber, but we're bringing that in. Just got to expand the scope. That was the kind of the playbook for multi-domain operations. I think we just need to do a little bit more of it in a new domain in the future. It doesn't matter what your overmatch is, fog and friction, calling Dr. Clausewitz again, fog and friction are going to be there. Things are going to happen. You're not going to be able to identify that MiG-25, and you're going to have to go to the merge, things you would never anticipate. You got to be ready, right? It doesn't matter how much we're bringing to the fight. There's still going to be some things that we don't anticipate. And I put on here, and you'll be happy because we were talking dumb bombs earlier, low-cost, low-tech weapons can still have strategic effects, whether we're talking the red side with Scuds or we're talking the blue sides. So those are some things that I think we still need to keep in mind and for the next fight, whenever that's going to be.
I think given 21st century, what I expect 21st century thresholds for casualties and blood and treasure in theater campaign, it's going to be important to win fast. I think across the board, across the entire range of combat power, what sort of capabilities do we need to win as quickly as possible? And that's something we need to be ever mindful of.
Well, Slam, it was a fun conversation. We hit a lot on Desert Storm. I'm sure there's a lot that we miss, and I'm sure that we've probably made a couple of misstatements or got a couple of facts wrong. But I think overall, we talked about a lot of the really important things that we need to take out of Desert Storm. I really appreciate you coming on with me. Thank you very much.
Dude, thanks for having me, and I look forward to listening to this and future podcasts. It's been awesome.
All right. Thanks, Slam. Have a good night. All right, that does it for my marathon 2-hour interview with U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry, where we were talking, certainly not all of, but a lot of the major events of the Operation Desert Storm air campaign. As I mentioned in the intro to the first half of my interview with the Slammer, we're not historians. We talked about the events and the topics we thought were important. We know we missed some things. We probably got some things wrong. I know we had some misspeaks. I'd love to engage with you, the air-minded listeners, on what we missed, maybe what we got wrong, or even if you're so inclined, what we got right, maybe something that we said that resonated with you or something that you didn't know about. You can reach me at airmindedpodcast@gmail.com, or you engage me on social media where I'm active as @airmindedpod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are my own, and on the last two, Chris Gentry, and they do not reflect the official views of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force. Be sure to check out the final episode in the Desert Storm 30 arc, my interview with MiG Killer and air superiority expert Rick Clouseau-Tellini. This is the Air-Minded Guerrilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off and saying thanks for listening, and see you next time on the Air-Minded Podcast.